Turkish National Police arrested the man last Friday in Istanbul. Secret Service spokesman Ed Donovan says the president was never in any immediate danger. Mr. Obama did not arrive in Turkey until Sunday, 2 days after the man's arrest. Donovan says the Secret Service is not releasing any information about the suspect. Donovan says that as a standard procedure involving a threat against the president overseas, the Secret Service is following up with Turkish authorities regarding the case. Italian officials say 207 people were killed by yesterday's earthquake. The quake was centered in central Italy near the town of L'Aquila, about 70 miles northeast of Rome. The quake had a magnitude of 6.3. It brought down ancient and modern buildings in the town. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Lumber Liquidators, whose flooring includes pre-finished and stained solid hardwoods, bamboo, and cork. Information at lumberliquidators.com.
WILL weather is made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors in Ogden, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties.
Life's a journey. Take someone with you.
Hi there, I'm Noah Adams.
This is Lisa Mullins.
I'm Celeste Quinn.
This is AM 580 News Director Tom Rogers.
I'm Leanne Hansen.
You depend on us for programs that help you navigate life, and we depend on you for financial support that makes them possible. Give to our member match fund today, and we'll use your dollars on April 15th to challenge others to join you in supporting WILL. Go to willpledge.org or call 217-244-9455.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. In recent years, women in South Asian communities in the United States have become politically active in a number of areas, and this involvement has been particularly important in the effort to end violence against women in the family. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with the co-founder of an organization based in New Jersey. It's a women's rights organization with a particular focus on women of South Asian descent. It's called Manavi Incorporated and has been around since 1985. Our guest is Dr. Shamita Dasgupta. She is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. She's here to give this year's Balgopal Lecture on Human Rights and Asian Americans. And this talk will take place at 7 o'clock tonight at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. In addition to her involvement, continuing involvement with Manavi, she is an adjunct professor of clinical law at the NYU Law School. And we're pleased to have her here on the program. Questions as we talk are welcome. People can be involved in the conversation. The only thing we ask of people calling in is that people just try to keep their comments brief, comments and questions brief, so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible. But anyone certainly should feel welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions, comments are welcome. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
I think that it's true, and you can tell me, that at the time that you were involved in founding Manavi, was there anything else like it in the United States?
No, actually, there wasn't. And we didn't know about that at that time. So what happened was we found out later on that we got the credit for being the first organization in the U.S. focusing on violence against women within the South Asian community.
And was that from the very first the thing that you chose to focus on?
And absolutely not. We had no idea what was going on within our community. What we did, six of us, we just got together by chance. We thought we would go into our communities and talk to women and find out what was going on with immigrant women, because we were, all of us were immigrant women at that time. And we thought, what, we were just out of graduate schools or in graduate school, so we thought, well, let's look at what was happening with the women and what's the need there. And the moment we started, the word got out that there's a women's group that's establishing itself, women started calling us and saying that, well, this is what's happening to me. I'm being battered by my intimate partner or battered by family members. And we changed our focus at that point immediately and said that, oh, we can't do research. That's so academic, and we need to really listen to the women, our sisters, and think about how we can support them, how we can help them.
And did it surprise you that of all of the various things that women might have said, I want to talk about this aspect of my experience, did it surprise you that domestic violence was the thing that everybody seemed to want to talk about?
Absolutely. We had no idea because we had, by that time, we assumed that our community was immune to all of that. We were just a model minority, a wonderful group of people who were establishing ourselves in this country. We were successful financially, economically, educationally. So we, like almost everybody else, assumed that there's no problem in the community. So it did surprise us that women, large numbers of women, started calling us and talking about domestic violence and the problems that happened when they tried to access recourses for it.
Well, certainly we know that for a long time, it was difficult. This was a difficult thing. It didn't matter who you were. It was a difficult thing to get people to talk about. People didn't want to admit that it was, for various reasons, people had a hard time talking about it as if it was part of their own experience. And that it seems that then layered on top of that for people in the South Asian community, there were all sorts of reasons why people didn't want to talk about it. And you pointed at some of them, and maybe we can talk some more about some of these things. Either people thought, well, it's not because we're well-educated and successful, it's not going to happen here. That was probably one reason people didn't even – they weren't aware of it. But also I'm sure that there were some people who did not want to discuss it for the other reason that you mentioned, and that is – they would say, if we talk about this openly, it will reflect very badly on our community. And that's not the image we have of ourselves, and that's not the image we want people to have of us.
You've hit all the right points. Shame. First of all, for everyone, I think, not just South Asians, it's very difficult to talk about intimate partner abuse. Women are ashamed. Women a lot of time believe that it must be something in themselves that brings this about. So it is difficult for everyone. Then we have the other added problem that most of us like to distance ourselves from horrible things in life. You know, it's not me. It's somebody else that it's happening to. I'm not a part of all of this. So that kind of a distancing happens. And there is, of course, the whole issue that we shouldn't wash our dirty laundry in public. You know, what would happen then? People are going to look at us. And as immigrants, as such, there's a lot of problems we have to deal with in terms of how, what's the image of our community in the larger community. So in this sense, everyone was afraid that our community is going to look bad. It's going to be shamed, and we shouldn't talk about it.
Yeah. And this certainly, I think we should point out that the kinds of things that you're talking about, they're not unique to the South Asian community, that we know that domestic violence cuts across all sorts of lines, across socioeconomic lines and ethnic lines and racial lines. And also, I suppose you'd want to say, make the point that it's not necessarily a bigger problem in the South Asian community than it is in the American community at large.
Yes, you're right. I mean, that's exactly what the problem is. However, what happens is because we are immigrants, because we are new to this country, because the laws are different, because the social structure is different here, that added problems come to us. And we don't know. We might not know how to deal with those. So it's not as though the problem is bigger, but the problem has different nuances.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it becomes complicated because here we have women, families, people who may well have a foot in two different worlds. They're still rooted in the culture and the values of the place that they came from, but they're now living in the United States where things might or might not be different. And I suppose that people maybe are having a hard time placing themselves, that is, figuring out, well, where they are and how is it they're going to live, or maybe how they, you know, what options are there, mm-hmm. are there for the way that they're going to live.
And they also, you know, on top of that, what you've said, they bring with them views of police and law enforcement and legal systems. So that's a huge issue, that who do I turn to? Who am I in this society? I'm thousands of miles away from the family. What if I have a, you know, separate from my husband and separate from my partner? And the family says, oh, I thought everything was going fine, and they're 10,000 miles away. They have no idea. And I thought everything was going fine. Maybe you've just become too different once you get to America. So maybe it's your fault. Maybe it's not not what's happening there. And you have to understand that batterers use that very well. Abusers a lot of time pick up on that and tell the women, if you leave me, if you dare to leave me, I'll let everyone in your family know that you're running around with someone else. You've become too, quote-unquote, Americanized. You're not the good Indian woman who your family thinks you are. So all of these kinds of pile up on women, and it silences them. And it becomes very difficult to ameliorate the situation, change the situation.
Yeah. And I'm sure that it's also true that these women have very strong feelings about family, about their children if they have children, and that for that reason, I'm sure that they're strongly committed to that idea. So perhaps for them, it becomes more the idea of leaving a husband with everything. All of the things that would attach to that might be seen as almost impossible.
If not impossible, definitely
very difficult.
And yes, you know, it's my child should have a father, regardless of how that father treats me. How am I going to bring up a child alone in this country? What if my old grandmother in India hears that I'm alone, and how is that going to affect her? We come from a pretty collective community, pretty collective society. So it's not me as an individual who counts as much as my family does. My grandmother, my uncles, my extended family, my friends, all of these people are important in my lives. So when I make a decision or when I take a decision, I know that's going to affect a large circle of people. So it becomes even more important that I'm cautious about taking that decision. And if it serves by sacrificing my happiness to a certain degree, perhaps I should do that.
Well, and I guess I understand, too, that maybe – and some of the women we're talking about in some of the communities that they come from, that they're the idea of bearing up under difficult circumstances is a kind of a value that gets instilled mm-hmm. in one. That's just, well, you know, life is sometimes difficult. But what that just means is that you have to try harder. You have to, you know, what there's this idea that whatever is visited upon you, that's what you have to live with.
Yeah, that's your lot in life, mm. perhaps. I think to a large degree in South Asian cultures, or most South Asian cultures, I would say, suffering and sacrifice, those are valorized. So it's assumed that a woman who sacrifices, a woman who really tries hard is going to be valued in society, is going to be awarded something greater in after she passes on to another life. So women try very, very hard to make families work, make marriages work. So it's not something that they would take on or make an easy decision about to break a family, to say, I cannot bear this anymore. This is intolerable. Or even speaking about domestic violence, which one of my friends says, speaking the unspeakable, that's a very big issue in our community, yeah. Women.
Just to introduce again our guest, we're speaking with Dr. Shamita Dasgupta. She is adjunct professor of clinical law at NYU Law School and is co-founder of Manavi Incorporated. This is a New Jersey-based women's rights organization with a special focus on women of South Asian descent. They have been around since 1985, and as she explained, the main focus didn't start out to be domestic violence, but very quickly that became the focus as women from South Asian women came to them and said, look, this is what's happening to me. This is my experience. And so they realized very quickly this is something that they had to respond to. She's here on the campus to give a talk. This is this year's Balgopal Lecture on Human Rights for Asian Americans. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on the U of I campus. And I believe that anyone interested should stop by and attend. Questions welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here. We'll welcome them into the conversation. They are in Champaign County here where we are. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. Many stories are told of the Islamic oppression of women, and it's sort of almost hackneyed or something, I guess. It seems to me that, you know, this culture has something like the law of the thumb, where violence against women was authorized by the male spouse for quite a few decades, and in some parts it still is obviously extant and doesn't need that kind of. But anyway, I wanted to ask about, you know, sort of anything you can say to illuminate the problem that the Hindi culture, the dominant culture in India, has as far as these kind of cultural predispositions. I guess arranged marriages are not doesn't have much to do with it, but I don't know. I just don't know what kind of cultural forms there are that sort of underpin that somehow, you know, authorize, legitimize, and whether there's anything. I mean, obviously there's probably strains both ways, but so I'm asking you to inform me on this if you could. I don't know if that's a formulated enough question, but I thought I'd ask you for some specifics, or if it's possible to do that.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you very much. It's a really important question that you bring in, and a couple of things. First of all, the Hindu culture doesn't, or any culture, I would say, doesn't necessarily approve of domestic violence as such. I think domestic violence, as you know, in every culture, it's a cultural phenomenon. In this country also, it is a cultural phenomenon as it happens. So to think about Hinduism or Islam as supportive of abuse of women more than any other culture, I'm not sure that works. However, the context of abuse is that how those religions or how those cultural contexts are being interpreted by men in power. For example, in Islam, there's a lot of rights of women that are coded in Quran that are not carried out. For example, in Quran, it says very clearly that a woman has a right to choose her partner. The woman must be educated equally with the male child. The daughter should be equally educated as the male. So those tend not to be carried out. However, some other pieces are misinterpreted and abuse of women goes on. My question has always been to people, or when women themselves come and say, oh, this is in my culture, I can't really do something about it. I always point out, both in Quran and both in Hinduism, that there are pieces that empower women and there are pieces that disempower women. How come the disempowerment or disempowering parts become popular and become more accepted than the empowering parts? And we really have to question to whose benefit is it to popularize and support the disempowering parts to women. And I think that's where we have to go. Both in Hinduism and Islam, there's a lot of abuse of women, just as it is in Christianity or Judaism or any other religion that you can think of. However, we have to unpack violence against women from religious contexts and cultures, and point out that these are not necessarily integral to that culture, and if we can get rid of it. And that's what I think almost all anti-domestic violence work is all about, to eradicate violence from wherever it exists.
Yeah. I read an interesting essay that you wrote. It was published a couple of years ago that really tries to get at this particular question, to sort out values, culture, religious, what people's attitudes were towards, particularly men's attitudes towards women. And you chose to look at the Jain because they have very strong nonviolence as a value within their faith and their way of living. The idea of nonviolence is very, very strong. And what you tried to do is get at attitudes of Jain men towards the subject of abuse of women, and found surprisingly for this group of people who say nonviolence is very, very important to us, at the same time, very, you know, surprisingly high levels of men who seem not really to have a big problem with abuse of women, or at least when it comes to husbands and wives, which says that maybe there's something going on here that's beyond one's religion and what it teaches.
I was very surprised. In fact, what we tried to do in that particular study was look. We picked the Jain community because of its adherence to nonviolence. They wouldn't even kill an ant. I mean, that's the religious dictum. However, when it comes to chastising women, it was perfectly okay. They see it's a husband's duty to chastise and, if necessary, physically correct women, chastise women. And they don't see any problem with that. So, obviously we have to think about how this particular issue of men correcting women, men controlling women's behavior has permeated every piece of our life. Mm. Every religion, the way we live and the way we think about gender relations, the way we conduct our lives on a day-to-day basis. So, and it's not easy to unpack it and to separate it because it's become natural, quote-unquote natural in our lives. It has been normalized in our lives, in every culture, I would say. And it's only by bringing those pieces out, making people aware, making people think about it, that we can say, we can start unpacking it or eradicating it in some ways.
Well, what in talking with women who are talking about their experiences, who say, "Look, this is I've experienced this violence, and I feel that this is just wrong. I shouldn't have to. I don't want to. It's bad for me. It's bad for the children. It's bad for the family. It's bad for everybody." And yet, on the other hand, if there's this competing set of values that say that you should be subservient to your husband, that there's a sort of a natural order of things, and that's part of it, and that's reinforced by your religious faith, how do you encourage a woman to think about that and weigh all of these things?
That's a really difficult issue. And a lot of advocates talk about this and think about it. And so did I. When women first started coming to us in Manavi and saying that, this is my religion, this is what's said to me, I really didn't know how to argue against that. Mm-hmm. I had to go back, and that's where my religious education came in, and I had to bone up on Islamic religious texts and Hinduism, and really learn it well, mark the passages that empower women, and that's what I brought to them next. I said, well, okay, so you think your religion says this, but your religion also says a woman should be honored in the family. A mother must be honored in the family, otherwise there is no God in that family. And how do you work with that? How do you deal with that? So pointing out to women the pieces that are really empowering, and then saying, how come those pieces have become invisible in our lives? Women just wake up to that and say, oh my God, yes, of course. And that's just such a wonderful, wonderful experience to see women for the first time saying, my God, this is fabulous. I never thought of it like that. Oh, okay. So now that means that I have a recourse. I have a way of getting out of this. So that's fabulous to see. And that's how we tend to work, to take out in our histories, in our mythologies, in our religion, in our folk tales, pieces that empower women. And in the history of resistance, because in both in South Asia, there's a huge history of resistance, women's resistance to violence, to oppression, to bring those out. And many of those women are seen as heroes in our community. Mm-hmm. So pointing those women out and saying, wouldn't you rather be like her?
Mm. Let's talk with someone else, someone here on a cell phone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes. Yes. I'm wondering if your guest can understand or articulate the effects of our male-dominated society. It's called paternalism, as opposed to maternalism, which preceded the male dominance of kinetic existence of everything. And women, you know, who were relegated then to a subservient position and with no power, and suddenly, you know, I appreciate organizations that your guest is speaking of, but how is that going to change the dominance of males and what they do both socially and around the world? And it proceeds on a pattern, in my opinion. So perhaps you could address some of those questions, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right.
That's a huge question, because you're absolutely right. Patriarchy and androcentrism, masculinism, is what is at the bottom of women's oppression and relegation of women to marginal states and out of the circle of power and control, so to speak. And in one sense, I'm not sure that I would want the whole society to go back to matriarchy, but rather I would much rather have all societies work on a very equal basis, both for males and females. And it should be that we have much more of a partnership in leading our lives. How do we do that is the question that I think we are all struggling with, and we are all working in small areas. But I also want to bring something else, that oppression is not just based on gender, that oppression has interlocking systems, such as poverty and homelessness and sexuality. All of these are points of oppression that we in a society keep using to marginalize people. So, you know, in addition to gender, we have to think about the poor woman who's a darker skin color, who may be a lesbian, who may be disabled. So these are pieces of oppression that work with us or oppress us continuously. So we have to think about that. And we have to, and I do see it as a multi-pronged effort, that each of us who are working in different areas trying to dismantle the oppression come together in our efforts and try to see if we can build a equal society, not just break something down, but how to build it, how to create it, that which is much harder.
We are just a little bit past our midpoint. I have another call I will get to in just a moment. I do want to introduce, though, our guest for this hour of the show. Dr. Sharmita Das Dasgupta is co-founder of Manavi Incorporated. This is a New Jersey-based women's rights organization with a focus on women of South Asian descent. And one of the things from the very beginning, when this got started in 1985, one of the things that they were particularly interested in was the problem of domestic violence within the South Asian American community. She's here to give the Balgopal Lecture on Human Rights and Asian Americans. That's this evening at 7 in the Alice Campbell Alumni Center. Anyone who is interested can stop by. She's also adjunct professor of clinical law at NYU Law School. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's another caller, someone in Urbana, in line 1.
Good morning. This is a very fine show. I taught adults from Southeast Asia, and when the women came to me about domestic violence, I went to people of their culture who were now American citizens and who were helping the new arrivals, and I was dumbfounded to find that these people that I went to for help then turned on the women and told them that they were bringing disgrace onto whichever country's community were here in Champaign-Urbana. And shamed the women for coming to me and telling me about this. And I very quickly learned that the last people that I would go to for help were people of that particular ethnic background who had been here most of them 20 years at that time and who in every other respect were very helpful to me and to the people, the new arrivals. And I honestly didn't understand that.
How do you, I appreciate the comment of the call, I'm turning to the guest here, and how do you, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but how do you meet a challenge like that if people within the community say, no, this is not, we don't want to talk about this because this reflects badly on the community? How do you go from there to promoting a kind of value that says we as a community should all stand up and say, no, this is wrong, and we shouldn't just stand by silently while this happens in our community?
This is a really fine question, and I think all of us who work within the community-based agencies have dealt with it. There are two issues here. First of all, there may be some entrenched interest in keeping women in control. So just assuming that they are within our community or these people are within the community and very helpful in other ways doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be helpful in terms of changing the situation of women. So that's one thing. Second thing is that this whole issue of somebody from the outside might come in and tell them what to do or how to do their how to work their lives is a big trigger for immigrant communities. And they might say, "Oh, you can't just come in and do this," and blame the women that you have now taken this out of the community and made us ashamed of ourselves. But I think it's really important to recognize that there is no reason why we would expect people to understand domestic violence and violence against women and work against it without preparation. In this country now, the situation we are in is the work of 30 or 35 years of awareness building and intervention work. So we can't just assume that people are going to know and understand it. So which means that organization or organizing the community is important. It is important to go out again and again, not at a crisis, but as such, and talk about domestic violence. Partner with somebody. Find that particular person or couple of people who are interested in changing society. Partner with them. Go out into the community. Organize it. Organize the community. Prepare the community to understand violence against women. The other piece is that organize the women themselves. Organize the women whose lives are at stake is what would bring huge change. They can then talk about what is happening in their own lives. So I think organizing is the key to this issue.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. It's very clear that when you and the other women who started Manavi came together, you had a very strong feminist perspective. I imagine, though, that in dealing with some people who are maybe a little bit more traditional or conservative in the community, being regarded as feminist probably didn't help you. Did that make it difficult when people wanted whatever kind of language they used, they were wanted to dismiss you because your political outlook did not line up with theirs?
Yes, it did. As a matter of fact, we were named all kinds of things. The homebreakers, people called us Danavi in Sanskrit. Danavi, which rhymes with Manavi, means monsters. And Manavi as such means women and kind of like an unadulterated essence of women. But we were called Danavi. So we were dismissed because we were thought of as these westernized, western-educated women who are coming in and telling us what to do. They have no idea what our community is like. So all of us literally had to a certain degree, prove that we are from the community, that we are not going to let these conservative groups kidnap our community. Hijack our community in any kind of way. This is our community. We claim it. And we also tried at that point showing to our community the history of resistance of women who were certainly not Western educated, who were indigenous women who have fought against it, who have worked against violence against women. So we came from that angle and claimed our community completely. And we were not going to let them take it away from us.
So from being something that started with a handful of women, how many women are now involved? And at this point now, it's been since 1985, are involved in Manavi.
Yeah, it's been an interesting ride for us, and we call it Journey to Justice. We have certainly about eight or nine people, nine staff. Members, they're paid staff, but we have very large number of volunteers and members who come in. We collaborate with Rutgers University, which is right next to us, so we have a number of interns who come in, paid interns as well as unpaid ones, volunteers. We work with attorneys who volunteer their time to us and doing pro bono work or being at the clinic, running the clinic for us, legal clinic. We have men who come in and do and work with us and support our work and support women's bid to live a violence-free life.
Hmm. Let's talk with another caller, someone also here in Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Hi there. I really appreciate your conversation today, and I really appreciate the speaker's sort of focus within the community in terms of the perspectives of, women's value within the community instead of, being sort of someone coming from outside of the community. But I guess my question was, how are you guys able to make collaborations with organizations in the U.S. that often have pathologized non-Christian, religions? And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Very important question. We actually have to do and we still keep doing a lot of education work with larger community organization. We have very good collaborative relationship with mainstream organizations. We actually are considered a service provider by the U.S. Violence Against Women Office. You have to be kind of vocal, and I think that's what we have been. We've been vocal and pushing our agenda, collaborating, learning from them, You know, I would never dismiss how much we have learned from mainstream organizations, but also teaching them, also saying that you have to move away from just a one model fits all type of thinking. So that's what we have been doing. So it's a lot of effort that needs to go into it, not just in terms of intervention with women who are experiencing battering, but also others who are stakeholders in this work.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Dr. Shamita Das Dasgupta. She is an adjunct professor of clinical law at NYU Law School. She is one of the founders of Manavi Incorporated. This is an organization, a New Jersey-based women's rights organization, been around since 1985. Their particular focus is on women of South Asian descent. And as she explained earlier in the interview, very quickly it became obvious that domestic violence was a big issue and became a major focus for them. She's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk tonight. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One thing that we haven't touched on, and I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about, is how the justice system has responded to the needs of this particular population and how they have related to it. And I think one of the things that you said a little bit earlier was that if you have people who may have come to the United States from a place where the police are not necessarily there to help you, and that people's feelings about the police and about the justice system might not be very positive. Might that lead them to be less inclined to want to get involved with the police?
In this country, the anti-domestic violence movement has really relied on law enforcement and the legal system to intervene in domestic violence situations. And to a certain degree, that has worked well, but not for all communities. As we know that communities of color have not necessarily benefited from such intervention completely. To a certain degree, it has, but it has also had its problems with it. In our community, it's a pretty similar situation. I think for a long time, we still are doing it. We've worked very closely with the police in New Jersey and New York area, but certainly New Jersey, to teach them about how our community works. You know, what the reactions of the women are, what they can do when they are called and they are the first responders to a particular situation. However, it doesn't necessarily work well all the time. Police are also, when they come in, because of the language barrier, a woman might not speak English as well as her abusive husband. They, you know, just for expediency, they move straight to the man to ask what's been happening here and not necessarily get the right picture. Or they may actually tell the women that you're the one who's making all of this trouble. I just heard a story, you know, a couple of days ago when this woman called and the police called 911, and the police came in and said that, questioned her in front of her husband. She didn't say anything. So they threatened her, said that if you call us again, we'll take your children away. So these kinds of things get stored in the community's memory and the collective memory, or they get passed on from mouth to mouth to different people. And the women are much more reluctant to call the police. After 9/11, that also happened, that women were very reluctant to call the police because of immigration atrocities that were happening at that time and problems that were happening at that time. However, I have to say that the police are still the first responders in this case. When that hand is out to hit you, or that gun is, or the man is saying that I'm going to kill you tonight, the first thing you can do is to call 911 and say, someone come and make me safe right at this point. And the problems are many. It's not just simple. The police comes in and everything becomes okay. However, it is something that we need to think about and change. And I think we are doing enough work with the police to make it a better responding system.
Mm. Well, are you in the position, can you be in a position to advocate for women if they can't advocate for themselves?
We do that all the time. The services that Manavi provides and the work that we do is linguistically and culturally appropriate. Mm-hmm. Those are the two keywords that we, you know, that we focus on. And we are there with women in courts, in medical appointments, and with the police, just mainly to support women and to advocate for women and talk for them if they have language problems or they're unable to say anything that is that they want to say and afraid to say it.
Mm-hmm. We, at the very beginning, you talked a little bit about the fact that when Manavi was, when you first got organized, there was not, in the United States, apparently there wasn't anything else like this. Certainly in the year since 1985, the population, the South Asian population of the United States has grown pretty significantly. Are there now other organizations, other places around the country that are like yours?
Absolutely. There are more than 24 organizations now around the country. Wonderful, very strong organizations advocating for women who are experiencing violence in the South Asian community. We, as from Manavi, we have a sister relationship with all of these organizations, and we work with them, collaborate with them. And every 2 years, Manavi hosts a conference for all the South Asian organizations, and we meet in New Jersey. We have a conference, 3 day, 2.5 day or 3 day conference. So it's an amazing opportunity for us to work together.
Yeah. We have someone calling in here from McLean County nearby. Let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just wanted to say that I deeply appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Because even though I was born in India and I've been here for many, I've been here twice as long as I've been in India. So, and I'm also married to an American, so it's never an issue, except I remember for some strange reason always telling my husband, if he raises his hand once, that'll be the last. Of course, he's an angel, so it wouldn't happen. But I know that having been raised in India, that it's interesting, as you brought up in the beginning, how the religion is about nonviolence, and the whole idea of karma is what you give out is what you get back. You know, and then the practice is so different. And it isn't always just physical abuse. There's always, you know, mental abuse or verbal abuse coming from, you know, families. And the thing that really amazes me and some of my American friends is how it's not just men who perpetuate the cultural abuse. It is also how the women who have been abused continue to allow that to happen. And that just amazes me. So I'm really grateful. But I just heard something that you may have already heard. There's some group of women in India. They're called the pink sari ladies or red sari ladies who are out there. If they find someone who's been abusing a woman and they find them and they beat them up, which I'm not saying violence is a good way, but it's like they bring them up to task and saying, you're not going to do this. But my bottom line is I'm so pleased with what you're doing, and I hope this is, you know, what you're doing is also happening in Chicago and L.A. and all those big Indian communities, because it's a problem. It's a problem in every country, every culture. And, you know, yes, as American women, we have come a long ways, but people from other countries have quite a ways to go. So thank you very, very much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. But I also want to point out something, that it's domestic violence is an issue in every community. And I think I didn't address it earlier. Someone called and talked about arranged marriage. But we know that neither arranged marriage nor companionate marriage, or as we know it as love marriage, is immune to domestic violence. It happens here. It's a huge problem in this country. It's a huge problem in the dating population. So it's everywhere, and we really need to think about treatment of women and how gender relationships shapes all of these issues. In Chicago, there is a wonderful organization called Apna Ghar, which is working in the South Asian community. along with other communities. So absolutely look them up, talk to them, volunteer your time, whatever you can do.
And I think we're now coming to the end of the conversation. We have a minute or two left, but I think that the caller raises a good point, and that is, you know, as we have talked and as I have asked the questions, I frame this as an issue between spouses, particularly between husbands and wives. But the fact is that the frame really is larger than that. There might be issues involving women and their husbands' mothers. Or perhaps other male relatives, so that it may be bigger and more complicated than, as if it's not complicated enough, husbands and wives, because it gets whole families involved.
Yes, and that's, I think, you know, I will be talking about it a lot more this evening, but that is an issue that we brought into the framework prevalent in this country about domestic violence. It was always thought of as an intimate partner relationship, that abuse was focused only in that area, which is absolutely not true. You know, other people in an extended family or in the family, and not just in South Asian community, by the way, we are finding out more and more in every community, when they are together or in any kind of family configuration, this happens. And in South Asia, you know, the proverbial and very, very famous mother-in-law abuse is a common and common issue. But the sisters-in-law and brothers-in-law or father-in-law, or for that matter, in the natal family, parents, you know, a woman is abused, or a daughter might be abused, so.
Well, we're at the point that we're going to have to conclude here our conversation. But for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, I want to mention once again that our guest, Dr. Shamita Das Dasgupta, is going to be giving this year's Balgopal Lecture on Human Rights in Asian Americans. And that's tonight at 7 o'clock on the U of I campus at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center. Anyone who is interested should feel welcome. Also, if you're interested in finding out more about Manavi, they do have a website. And this is the name of this organization, MANAVI, based in New Jersey. Their website is manavi.org, so you can go there and you can find out more about the organization. And thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure.
Programs here on WILL are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services. More information available at 356-3736. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan for State of Illinois employees and is accepting new patients. The customer is always right. Whatever happened to that approach to customer relations? Next time, coming up on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll go inside the multi-billion-dollar global customer service industry as Celeste Quinn talks with journalist Emily Yellen. They'll talk about its history, how it works, and why so often it seems things go so wrong. Emily Yellen is the author of the book Your Call Is Not That Important to Us, and they'll be talking following the 1 o'clock news. That's part of the Afternoon Magazine. The show gets underway at noon here on AM 580. Coming up in the next part of this program, we'll be talking with Andrea Tone. She is an historian who's interested in the social history of medicine. She teaches at McGill University. And we will talk with her about a recent book that she's written that looks at the history of America's turbulent affair with tranquilizers. And this is in large part about the development and the popularity of the drug Miltown, which was very big in the early 1950s. More on that in the next part of Focus. First, though, we'll break, as we usually do, for an update on the markets and news. So please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Nearbys in the soybean pit are showing some renewed vigor at this hour. The deferred still a little bit to the downside. Chicago Board of Trade soybeans are showing some strength, led by the old crop months, on what traders say is a strong U.S. export pace, as well as some talk among U.S. exporters that China is in the market again, looking for U.S. soybeans for May and June shipment. U.S. values are about 5 cents above their Brazilian counterparts, but Brazil nearby supplies remain tight. as the harvest is underway down there in Brazil. Let's go ahead and look at particulars in Kansas City. May wheat now at 610 and a half, up 7 and a half. July, 620 and three quarters, up 7. At the Chicago Board of Trade, May wheat, 558 and three quarters, up 1 and three quarters. July, 571, up 2. May corn, 402 and a quarter, down 3 and a quarter. July, 412 and a half, down 3 and a quarter. December, 433 and a half, down 3 and a half. March of 2010, 444 and a half, down 3 and a half. May crude oil, 49.83, is down $1.21.